From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. No police officers were charged in the shooting death of Breonna Taylor, a nurse in Louisville, Kentucky, who was killed when law enforcement entered the apartment that she shared with her boyfriend at night more than 6 months ago. Taylor's case has become as high profile as the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and calls for justice for her have fueled the Black Lives Matter movement. The only charges announced after a grand jury investigation were against one of the three officers whose bullets apparently endangered Taylor's neighbors. Critics have pointed out that the officer was essentially held accountable for not shooting at Taylor. Kentucky's Attorney General Danielle Cameron, a rising GOP star, said as a speaker during last month's Republican National Convention that his party, quote, will never turn a blind eye to unjust acts. On Wednesday, he exonerated law enforcement and oversaw what many feel was a gross miscarriage of justice. Cameron enjoys the support of President Trump, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and the Fraternal Order of Police. We turn now to Andrea Ritchie, the researcher in residence on race, gender, sexuality, and criminalization at the Barnard Center for Research on Women, co-author of Say Her Name, Resisting Police Brutality Against Black Women, Queer Injustice, the Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States, and Invisible No More is also her book, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Earlier this year, she co-wrote an article called We Want More Justice for Breonna Taylor Than the System That Killed Her Can Deliver. Welcome to the program, Andrea.
Thanks so much for having me, Sonali.
It seemed as though you and your co-author in July knew that this would happen when you wrote that piece in Essence magazine. The same system that killed Breonna Taylor is supposed to hold her killers accountable. And of course, it couldn't and it didn't, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, the outcome was predictable. I mean, just based on the reality of the system that drove the officers to her door and justified shooting her and killing her as she slept in her bed is certainly not the system that's going to hold itself accountable or deliver justice in her case. And that is borne out by our experience over at least the entire lifetime of police for sure, but certainly in terms of data that we have over the last 15 years, there have been a total of 110 prosecutions for police officers killing people. And since at least 2014, the data we have from The Guardian or The Washington Post databases, because of course there's no official data collection, shows that police kill upwards of 1,000 people a year. So in other words, over the past 15 years, we've had prosecutions in 10% of the number of cases of police killings annually. So it was fairly predictable. And then also given the circumstances of the case and the law that definitely favors police officers in terms of their perception of danger, whether it's rooted in reality or anti-blackness or not, it was certainly foreseeable. And then certainly the signals that were sent out by the LMPD declaring a state of emergency days ahead of the announcement indicated that this was going to be the response. But I think the point of the article that my colleague and comrade Mariam Kaba and I wrote was that this is foreseeable and that it's happened over and over and over again. And that as people who want justice for Breonna, for her family, for her community, it's really long past time for us to look to other approaches to striking at root causes of the problem, to looking to other frameworks for accountability, like reparations frameworks used in Chicago, and to ultimately, the ultimate form of accountability is to defund and dismantle the police department that killed her and invest money in the safe communities and institutions that would keep her safe. And that is exactly what organizers on the ground are demanding. If people follow BLM Louisville, their focus has always been on defunding the police department that killed Breonna Taylor, investing in the communities and institutions that would keep her safe and prevent future killings, and ensuring that accountability comes in ways that don't rely on the system that killed her to produce it, including immediate termination without pension of the officers who killed her, and holding the mayor responsible by firing and or impeaching or forcing his resignation. And so those are the demands that are coming from the ground. Those are demands rooted in the reality of the criminal punishment system and in what would actually strike at root causes and produce greater safety in the future.
In the actual case where she was killed, it's so interesting to think about the fact that the officers entered her apartment that she shared with her boyfriend. And he, not knowing these were police officers, he had a gun, he shot at them. And of course, we know that when white people do that, it's called stand your ground, or it's called justifiable defense. They're defending themselves. This is what the Second Amendment, in the words of the gun rights folks, say, you know, is there, gives them the right to do so. But somehow that is never applicable to people of color, and particularly armed Black Americans.
That's certainly the case. I mean, people have often said to me, you know, well, what if we don't, if we defund the police, if we abolish police, what do we do in the case of home invasion? And I remember one time thinking, being genuinely confused by the reporter's question by saying, I mean, what, you mean the home invasion that Breonna Taylor died in? You know, I mean, I feel like there's an excision of police violence in our understanding of what gun violence is, or what violence is generally, and we need to attend to that. And we also need to attend to the fact that while Breonna's life was unique and her loss is unique to her family and her community, and I don't want to downplay that in any way, she is far, unfortunately, from the first Black woman to be killed in the kind of home invasion called a no-knock drug warrant raid that she was, certainly far from the first, and I'm sad to say far from the last, until we end the war on drugs, not just the particular form that those raids take.
One of the three officers, Jonathan Mattingly, had sent a mass email to his fellow officers that was leaked to the press, and it revealed, you know, the sort of prevailing attitude among cops. He wrote to his fellow officers, "You do not deserve to be in this position, the position that allows thugs to get in your face and yell, curse, and degrade you." He also went on to describe, you know, the way in which he views how officers are seen. He said, "We all signed up to be police officers. We knew the risks and were willing to take them, but we always assumed the city had your back. This is not an us against society, but it is good versus evil." There's so much to unpack here. I mean, so he basically sees himself as good, and the people, by virtue of them being killed, must necessarily be evil.
I mean, there's no question that the United States is built on a presumption that a Black woman, no matter what she's doing, including sleeping in her bed, represents, you know, quote unquote, evil or danger or threat or something to be contained, controlled, and punished and killed and is disposable. And that's clear also from the police reports that described the incident as one in which no one was injured, when a Black woman bled to death in her own bed as she slept in her home. And so I think that his, you know, description is certainly consistent with not just the views of an individual police officer, but the views of an entire profession, and certainly the views of the cities that do back police officers time and time and time and time again when they engage in this kind of behavior, including that officer who still has his job. So as he has engaged in this kind of behavior. So I really want to highlight just how much those words that people are having a justified individualized reaction to are reflective of both perceptions of Black women's bodies and value and lives in this country, and also of the ways in which police and policing are set up to reinforce that, those structures of domination and power and disposability, and the ways in which they're supported in doing so by all of the structures in our society, which is why organizers at Black Lives Matter Louisville and across the country are demanding the dismantling of those systems and not just targeting individual officers.
Let's talk about Kentucky's Attorney General Daniel Cameron. He's a young Black man who is a Republican. He spoke at the GOP convention last month. He is someone that Trump called a star. He got married earlier this year, and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell attended his wedding. I want to play for you and our audience a clip of what Daniel Cameron said at the GOP convention, followed by a clip of what he said on Wednesday when he announced that essentially there would be no accountability for Breonna Taylor.
"Whether you are the family of Breonna Taylor or David Dorn, these are the ideals that will heal our nation's wounds. Republicans will never turn a blind eye to unjust acts.
According to Kentucky law, the use of force by Mattingly and Cosgrove was justified to protect themselves. This justification bars us from pursuing criminal charges in Miss Breonna Taylor's death.
And that is Daniel Cameron speaking Wednesday and invoking what we often hear prosecutors saying, which is that the legal framework just prevents them from charging officers. That they're, you know, and of course, there is some truth to that in terms of the qualified immunity that police officers enjoy. But there's also discretion, isn't there, at the hands of prosecutors, especially when they see that society is no longer willing to tolerate, you know, not just Black Americans, but Americans of all races, no longer willing to tolerate seeing Black people being killed by police. And somehow, they keep bringing up the law to justify why officers can't be charged. How do you respond, Andrea?
I mean, it's no accident that the law permits this kind of decision on his part and, in fact, requires it. The law has, I mean, in the United States for a long time didn't recognize the rape of Black women as a crime. Mm-hmm. Certainly for the entire period of chattel slavery, didn't recognize the killing of Black people as a crime, except as a crime against property of the person who claimed to own them. And so the law is definitely set up to protect officers like the one quoted saying the city doesn't protect us, when in fact the entire machinery of the law protects officers. And while qualified immunity is a doctrine in civil litigation, the law of self-defense, and particularly of, you know, what reasonable use of force is, it's reasonable in the eyes of an officer, it's reasonable in a very subjective way, and even the parts of the standard that talk about objective reasonable, whether something's objectively a reasonable use of force, look at it through the lens of perceptions of Black women that I was describing, that essentially deem Black women a threat even when they're sleeping in their bed. And so, and a threat that can be met with deadly force even when sleeping in their bed. And so I think that it's also important for folks who sort of are sort of pushing for reform and sort of more progressive prosecutors, or prosecutors who will take it upon themselves to rectify these kinds of injustices or demand accountability, that in fact, a prosecutor's job is to uphold the current system. It's not to seek justice for people the system is set up to kill. And so it's not surprising to me, any stretch of the imagination, that this was his decision, or that he felt justified in pointing to the law for that decision, or that there's even been a statement that sort of flips the script and says that demanding justice for Breonna Taylor is some form of mob rule, when in fact what we're demanding is accountability for mob rule that allows a mob of people to come barging into your home and terrify people at 3 a.m. and ultimately kill them. And so I really want to name that there's this, it's no accident the law comes out in the way that it does, and that it's also set up to rationalize no accountability for police officers who kill a woman sleeping in her bed, in such a way that the folks who are demanding accountability for this are framed as, you know, going against the rule of law, because the rule of law is set up to justify this kind of killing.
The city of Louisville, just a few weeks ago, settled on a wrongful death lawsuit that Breonna Taylor's family brought to the tune of $12 million and an array of police reforms. Doesn't that settlement, essentially, isn't it an admission of the fact that she should never have been killed? And if she should never have been killed, and yet nobody was held accountable, essentially the city is asking her family and society to accept her death, simply accept it.
I think that's right. I think that, often the city explicitly, when they're signing settlement agreements like this, make explicit in the legal papers that there's no admission of guilt, right, and that they're just doing it for the sake of saving time and money and, you know, litigation, the burden of litigation. What I want to say is that in the article that Mariam and I wrote, we talked about a reparations framework, mm-hmm. which is a framework that has been constructed to address state violence, and that certainly compensation is part of that framework. There is no doubt that Breonna Taylor deserves compensation, and there's no amount of money that compensates for human life. So that is absolutely true. And that the other parts of reparation include acknowledgement, which they didn't get, of the harm done and the violation of human rights. And it includes a guarantee of, well, first of all, a cessation that the kind of systems that are in place that killed Breonna Taylor won't be allowed to continue to operate, or the policies and practice won't be allowed to continue, and a guarantee of non-repetition. And so to the extent that there are still warrants permitted that allow police officers to barge into your house and maybe give slightly, you know, 30 seconds warning or a minute warning at 3 a.m, it might as well be none, is not meeting the condition of reparations. It's not meeting a condition of guarantee of non-repetition, and of cessation of the systems that created the harm. And the fact that the city of Louisville continues to invest more money in the department that killed Breonna Taylor than in any other department, including departments and programs that would prevent gun violence, that would fuel libraries and community safety and the things that the residents of Louisville need to heal from this violation, gross violation in their midst, but also to survive the pandemic, the economic crisis that it's triggered, and the climate catastrophe that we're living through. And so I think there's so much more to a reparations framework than the city has offered through this settlement, and there's so much more to demand. And one thing, a point of hope that we point out in the article, is that there is, you know, a city council resolution on the table to begin a process of investigating the root causes that contributed to this, and that would offer an opportunity to move forward with a broader conception of reparations and healing, and actually striking at the root causes that killed Breonna Taylor.
There was a huge movement around justice for Breonna Taylor and her specifically by name. Celebrities, wore t-shirts and carried signs, arrest the cops that killed Breonna Taylor, over and over again. This was, you know, a theme that we've seen, specifically calling for an arrest of the police officers. But you write in your piece, "Why are we asking the police to stop being the police?" over and over again, ultimately calls for collective responses rooted in arrests and prosecution are likely to lead to dead ends and deep disappointments. And certainly there has been a deep disappointment, sense of despair around the thousands and thousands of people that have marched, not just in Louisville, but all over the country, calling for justice for her from the very system that, of course, is incapable of delivering justice to her. You mentioned in your piece that there is an act called the Breathe Act that BLM has called upon to support. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about that.
Certainly. I do want to say that the attention to Breonna's case at all levels has been certainly incredible. My book is entitled Invisible No More. In some ways, it's a statement of fact. And in this case, that is certainly true, that the attention to Breonna's case is so much greater than it's been to any woman's case of police violence or killing since, for the 25 years I've been engaged in this work. So I'm certainly grateful for that. And what we say in the article is that all of that energy going towards a strategy that was almost guaranteed to not deliver healing, justice, repair, prevention, accountability, it feels like a lesson we should have learned. And that if all of the energy at all levels had been directed towards demanding reparations for Breonna, for her family and her community, we could have maybe been further along on that agenda for now. And so she deserved more, her family deserves more, communities deserve more, all of us in the streets saying her name and demanding justice deserve more. And our hope was to sort of expand our vision of what was possible so that we could direct our energies towards that. The Breathe Act does represent, is a representation of a much more expansive vision, and it is rooted in a reparations framework for survivors of police violence, families of people who don't survive police violence like Breonna Taylor's, and for the communities impacted. And it draws on examples of reparations throughout history for state violence and state-sanctioned violence in the U.S. and globally, and advances a vision of how that could be set up and constructed for that. It also is essentially a federal bill to defund the police, to dismantle the systems and institutions that killed Breonna and that are continuing to enact violence against the people protesting and demanding justice in her name. So it is a federal defund the police bill that also makes provisions and establishes many mechanisms for the kind of deep and broad and sustained and intensive investment in our communities that we need to achieve genuine safety for Brianna and for everyone in her community.
It's amazing to, I want to bring up the sort of conservative pushback and view that dominates so much, especially right wing, but even some mainstream media coverage of these issues that, you know, in one breath will condemn the killings of people like Breonna Taylor and George Floyd. On the other hand, will try to give equal weight to, you know, what they call rioting and looting. One of the things that you hear, especially from the right, is if you know that we should just arrest the folks that are rioting and looting. That's an immediately quick way to stop it. But then they never apply that same standard to police. If you just arrest the police who killed Black people, maybe that too would go a long way toward preventing police violence. But somehow that standard isn't applied to it. Also, we see even from those who, for example, on Wednesday, when Trump was asked about a peaceful transfer of power during the election, he said he basically refused to commit to a peaceful transfer of power. But the journalist asking the question talked about rioting in the streets. Never connected it to a demand for justice and accountability for the police. So there's all of this talk about rioting in the streets, but it's not contextualized. And that's problematic, right?
On so many levels. I mean, first, I just want to say that, you know, arrests don't prevent violence. Right. They don't, no matter who's arrested, they simply reinforce existing systems and relations of power and perpetuate violence, to be honest. And the police have been rioting in the streets consistently for decades, but certainly since May 24th, I have personally been witness to police rioting in the streets in New York and have seen video of police rioting in the streets across the country. So I feel clear about who's rioting. And I also feel clear about who's looting. And to the extent that police are, we currently spend over $100 billion a year on law enforcement in this country, while shelters have no money, unhoused people have nowhere to sleep, food banks are bursting at the seams in terms of demand in this moment. We're facing mass evictions. We're facing a mass extinction event in terms of climate change. I'm clear where the looting is happening. And I certainly, you know, often say also that, you know, police are literally looting the resources that Black trans women need to stay safe, that Black queer people need to stay safe, and certainly that Breonna Taylor, her family and community need to stay safe. So I think, again, there's a sort of normalization of when we talk about gun violence, we're not going to talk about the fact that 10% of gun violence every year is perpetrated by police officers. When we talk about rioting, we're not going to talk about the behavior of police officers on the streets in Louisville, which you can see on video anywhere. You know, we're not going to talk about the looting of resources of every municipal budget where the vast majority, including in Louisville, over 50% goes to law enforcement while libraries close, shelters close, programs for queer youth, trans youth, any youth, elders, community members close, teachers are laid off, park workers are laid off. I mean, it feels clear to me that, you know, we need to look at these things through the lens of the reality, right? I think also there's a need in this moment to divest from policing, not just financially, but emotionally and ideologically. I think, you know, we see policing and punishment as the only way of accountability. And when people harm us, that's the thing that we want to see, even though one, we know it doesn't work, two, we know it won't prevent the next thing, and three, it doesn't address the root causes and harm of what's happening. So it individualizes what, as we describe in our article, is a collective and systemic problem. And so I feel like that's an essential thing to keep in mind in this moment. And the last thing I really want to say about the acknowledgement, what many of us have known for some time about Trump not being in any way guaranteeing a peaceful transition of power, and in fact guaranteeing that there won't be one, is something that we need to pay attention to. We really need to not write this off as, you know, exaggeration or hyperbole. We need to pay attention to how the police are rioting in the streets now and what that's going to look like as the election approaches and in the aftermath of the election. And we need to be prepared for what that looks like and to be planning and organizing for how we're going to contend with that and what comes after. And certainly continuing to divest from the system that's making that possible, the criminal punishment system and the military-industrial complex, is going to be important to creating conditions where more of us are going to be able to exist past this moment.
Andrea, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful for your show.
My guest is Andrea J. Ritchie. She is the researcher in residence on race, gender, sexuality, and criminalization at the Barnard Center for Research on Women. She's written several books, including Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Earlier this year, she co-wrote an article with Marianne Kaba called We Want More Justice for Breonna Taylor Than the System That Killed Her Can Deliver. We'll add a link to that article from our website. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.